It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's been 16 years since the attacks on 9/11. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. On a clear September morning, the nation was shocked as two aircraft struck the Twin Towers of World Trade Center in New York. And then there was word of another passenger plane smashing into the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and a fourth crashed into the ground in Pennsylvania. President George W. Bush sat reading to a classroom when he first got word, and by the end of the day, flights around the country had been grounded. Within days, Americans would become familiar with the name Osama bin Laden and the organization Al-Qaeda. Subsequently, the nation went to war, first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. To look back on that day and to explore what we've learned and how the nation has changed, in our studio is Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University, and also by phone, Mukhtar Khan. He's a professor at University of Delaware. And welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Well, so let me ask you, Mike, where were you when the planes hit? How did you discover it? What was your reaction?
I was actually getting ready for class. I was at home, and I usually have Talking Heads news programs on while I'm doing it. So, all of a sudden, I saw the first tower hit, and it was an unbelievable sight, of course. And so I had enough time to stay for at least a half hour or so into that morning, and then I had to go off to class. That was my initial experience of it.
As events unfolded, I mean, what did you think in terms of why it occurred? Or
well, one of my areas of study ever since graduate school has been foreign policy in the Middle East. And I did, my initial reaction was this was blowback from to American foreign policy. That is clearly unjustified, but that this was not, I didn't have the experience that, oh my God, how in the world, why did this happen? I said, I understood almost instinctively why this was happening in some general sense as a an act of terrorism coming from that part of the world to the United States, and the reaction to perception of grievances against American foreign policy.
I mean, I must say, by the way, I was actually in Washington, D.C. at the time, sitting in a small office, not really, you know, preparing for whatever story I was going to prepare for, right? And I got this phone call and said, hey, did you hear about this plane crashing into the World Trade Center? And my immediate reaction was, well, it's probably some small plane. It's, you know, something came, of course. I mean, it's, you know, it's okay, fine. And then, of course, I turn on the TV and I see the second plane crash into the tower. And as a result, I said, oh, my gosh, we're going to have to do something. And then, of course, we got word, obviously, that the Pentagon a short time later. And, of course, then we went on the air at 10 a.m. and we're on the air all afternoon. And the thing that really struck me was how little everybody really knew. I mean, you got all these really strange reports. Like, for example, in Washington, D.C., apparently there was some smoke that was obviously drifting from the Pentagon. And somebody thought that actually some bomb had gone off at the State Department. That was one of the early reports. And as we sort of gathered more information, obviously that became apparent that no, that wasn't the case. So what did you make of the Bush administration's first reaction? I mean, obviously it took everybody by surprise. I mean, I know there was a report, and we can talk a little bit about that later, but they seem to be really caught off guard.
Yes, that was remarkable, given in the light of the fact that they certainly our intelligence services were aware of how terrorists can attack countries and how they do run planes into buildings and the like, and but it was clear that Bush himself had not been focusing on this kind of possibility, and was clearly taken aback and unprepared for immediate kinds of reactions at that point.
Because, I mean, it's as I understand it, that most of the discussions that were taking place inside the administration were actually discussions about Iraq. Now, part of that is a result of, to be fair, part of that was a result of the fact that sanctions have been on for a very long period of time, that people, that various countries, including the French and the Russians, were tiring of them, the community in general, because they thought they'd pretty much gotten everything that they were going to get. And that they decided to, as a matter of fact, I remember Colin Powell during that first year talked about smart sanctions, in other words, to lift the burden off of the Iraqi people themselves and try to more target them. And it they didn't. That was really the focus, I think, of the Bush administration in that run-up to 9/11 before they looked at al-Qaeda. And to be fair to them, there was intelligence and there was a report that we mentioned a moment ago indicating that they were looking at striking at the United States. But from their perspective, pre-9/11, such an attack, particularly one that was so successful, just wasn't on the radar screen.
Absolutely. I think the brazenness of it and the tactical sophistication about how al-Qaeda was able to, in effect, get members of that organization trained and into the planes and to use our own planes against us, I think was, that was the astonishment, I think, that, that struck certainly members of the Bush cabinet and Bush himself. And even perhaps within the intelligence community as well, even though they had, they knew that planes could be used, they at this level, I think that was a surprise.
The other thing that really was interesting as we sort of read back over the history is that there were people around bin Laden, and I think particularly his son, who said this is not a good idea, and because they were fearful that you would get a reaction.
Yes, well, certainly there was a split within, I think, al-Qaeda, because that was one worry. But the other manipulation here was that's precisely what we want. We want the United States to react and get deeply enmeshed in the Middle East and further undermine the credibility of the United States as being a good worker in the world. And indeed, the legacy is exactly that, if we can talk about that first.
I'm now have on the line Muqtadir Khan. He's a professor at University of Delaware. And Muqtadir, first I want to ask you, where were you when you first heard the news, and what was your reaction? What was your assessment of what was happening at that moment?
I was about to go and teach class. I was at that time in Ogden College in Michigan. And as I was going to the class, I heard the janitor say, planes crashed into World Trade Center. And I thought, I couldn't even understand what he said. So as I went to my class, I called my wife and said, just check on TV what was happening. And I went to the class, and then I got a text message from my wife saying, planes have crashed into the World Trade Center. We were all shocked, and I took my class to the lounge where we had a TV to watch. And so from around 8:30, 8:45, I think, I watched TV for a while. And then I was quite shocked. So I went to my office, and I wrote an op-ed saying, if this was done by Muslims, and it was published the next day in Detroit Free Press and Baltimore Sun and many places, and unfortunately, what I wrote in that article was quite predictive of what really happened with the U.S. response to 9/11, the decline of civil rights in the West, and of course the global rise in terrorism.
Let me ask you this: when you found that al-Qaeda was behind it, that Osama bin Laden was involved. What did you think the implications would be, particularly for U.S. foreign policy abroad? Because obviously Afghanistan at that moment still had bin Laden, and that it was clear that at least the United States was going to have to react in some fashion.
As most American Muslims, we strongly advocated a response, a military response. And I was actually writing and advising the government to actually put troops on the ground, find bin Laden. And I literally wanted him hanged from the football stadium where the Taliban used to execute some of their prisoners. And I thought if he went in there, found this guy, hanged him there in Kabul, this would be the end of it all. Al-Qaeda would go away. But you know what happened after that. This also became an excuse for a much more expansive foreign policy dealing with Iraq and the axis of evil and all of that. I wish we had managed to catch Bin Laden very soon after that. And then I think on hindsight, we would have had a much calmer post 9/11 era than we do now.
Well, let me ask you along those lines, because it seems to me that that's part of the issue in terms of the rise of al-Qaeda had to do with the war in Afghanistan in terms of the Soviets, and that we certainly obviously backed the Mujahideen, and that that became kind of a transformative ground for a lot of Arab Muslims in particular who came to that area. I think they were called Afghan Arabs at one point, coming to the area and basically being sort of radicalized or being informed about this idea that perhaps they could be part of this kind of movement, whether it was al-Qaeda on the one hand or maybe or any other group.
Well, there are two things. See, what happened was as we were supporting the global jihad against the Soviet Union, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan put together a partnership to create this basically, you can call it guerrilla force or a terrorist organization to harass the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. But it also became an excuse for those who were extremists, the kind who now join ISIS, to go out there and consider this as a religious duty to fight for Muslims against the Soviet Union. It was easy to get people upset with the Soviet Union because in Arabic Muslim languages, Soviet Union was addressed as a godless nation, an atheistic nation, because they were communists. But what also many Arab nations did was they got many of their criminals and prisoners to say, look, you're going to rot here forever. Why don't you go and fight in Afghanistan? So a lot of criminal elements went there, and Bin Laden was providing the word al-Qaeda means base. He had a house in Peshawar. He basically kept a database of these people so that when they died, their families could be informed about them. And then when the Iraq war started, at that time Bin Laden realized that he had an email list or whatever, database of 100,000 Afghan Arabs that he could mobilize. So that gave him an idea that, well, I can be a force too. And of course, a lot of this thinking came from Zawahiri, who was much of the brain. Bin Laden was more or less like a poster child that was used for fundraising and propaganda. But the brain, lots of people think that was Zawahiri, who is still out there.
Michael, I'm going to turn to you. So what do you make of what do you make of this?
I think that in hindsight, I mean, the legacy is a troubled legacy because what do we have? We have essentially we are deeply engaged still in war, 16 years in Afghanistan. We're still engaged, of course, with the Iraqi effort to put down ISIS. The sectarian, the religious sectarianism is worse now than it was previously. We've helped to unleash really the gates of hell with regard to the barbaric character of ISIS. The inequality, the political, rather the material and economic inequality within the Arab world remains at a height, a tall height, and additionally, there's really no advance in terms of democratic politics and individual rights and the like. And the United States is associated essentially with dictatorial regimes. What if the United States had responded quite differently to 9/11 rather than go to war, essentially, to overthrow the Taliban, to create essentially the instability of what we see today, but instead reacted as the British did when the IRA was putting bombs in bars in the late 60s, early 70s. What if we had pursued if you recollect, the initial reaction was not we ought to have to automatically go to war. There was at least a brief moment of saying, well, how do we go about, this was a criminal act, how do we go about capturing Osama bin Laden and arresting the criminals who engaged in this act. So would the legacy, I think, would be quite different. So we are facing, I would add additionally, what we have domestically is the rise, essentially, of an imperial presidency, that war, we continue to operate under the AUMF of of that period that has given rise not only to the continuation of the war in Afghanistan, but to essentially bombing at will by the president within Syria, within Iraq. The drone policy arose first with Bush and then was expanded considerably under Obama, operating under the same AUMF. So the imperial presidency continues and a decline in the role of our Congress. Again, a detrimental development in our own domestic politics. We're worse off, certainly. I mean, there's been, again, no resolution. So that the idea that we're over the period of blowback, again, if you interpret 9/11 as a major act of blowback from that region, that possibility remains alive.
Okay, we should note, by the way, that there was a bombing in London. We do not know exactly who was responsible for it. Suspicion is it was some group like al-Qaeda. And also, of course, we had the rejection, I guess, it was the U.S. Senate of an effort to repeal the original OK resolution to go after the terrorists. But all that stands kind of in contrast to the position that President Trump took, certainly during the presidential campaign, in which he ridiculed the invasion of Iraq, said that was a waste of time, and seemed to be saying, in effect, we got to be done with Afghanistan. Now, I realize that there's a certain campaign salesmanship involved with that, but there does seem to be, for the first time, particularly amongst conservatives and Republican electorate, an acceptance of the idea that maybe these things, the neocon vision that you've kind of described, is not necessarily acceptable. That if we pulled out, he wouldn't suffer.
Correct.
The kind of political consequences.
I think the American public's position has grown wearied, certainly, of war. So that on overall, the American public would be, I think, certainly be accepting or actually happy if we were to with pull back considerably. Hence, part of Trump's rhetoric during the campaign found resonance, I think, on that score. However, Trump, of course, speaks with forked tongue, because he'll say that on the one hand, and then he'll say the other, that you've got to simply obliterate these people, and you have to treat them as barbarians, and you just wipe them out. So it's not particularly surprising that once the generals got around Trump, they didn't have much trouble persuading him to stay in Afghanistan. In fact, to ultimately expand our footprint, I think. I mean, I think they're so, and that'll be in spite of where the public wants to go. So Trump is pursuing pretty much a foreign policy along the Bush line.
Although the increase in troops is much
smaller.
Fairly small. Yeah, to much be sure. We're not seeing a surge of 100,000, for example.
To be sure. But it is continuing, and it is contrary to some of the campaign rhetoric that Trump engaged in during the campaign.
Want to play for you. We went out and chatted with some people about what they thought, where they were, obviously, when they heard that the towers had gone down, and their own sense about where the country is. We'll go to that and then come back on the other side.
I was at General Services Administration in Washington, D.C., across the river from the Pentagon when it hit 9/11. So they evacuated our building. It was complete chaos. Metros were shut down. No phone communication. And it took them about 4 or 5 hours before we could even get transportation to get out of D.C.
I just remember it was traumatizing, glued to the TV, couldn't look away. I had a newborn son who was born that year, and, it just really hit home that those were other people's family and children, and it was definitely real. It was shocking.
I was living in Berlin that morning. I remember I just woke up, was lying in bed. And I thought to myself, what's going on? And then I realized when the second plane came, I went, oh, my God.
93.
And the Pentagon, I had friends that worked there. It was a very, very hectic day, very scary.
I thought it was going to be a continuing thing, like it was going to continue happening. I was pretty scared, not going to lie. I just remember just, like, people were just pulling people out of school, that we had to just stay, where we were.
Yeah.
I just remember it was just, like, scary. And now watching the video, I just couldn't wrap my head around what happened, why it happened.
And one of my friends at the point in time came out and said, Greg, they just hit the towers. And I was pretty surprised, you know, like, what? You know, I was very shocked. And then afterwards, about a couple minutes later, the other one got struck. I thought it was very strange.
I feel safe on a regular basis, but you just never know. I mean, how much can you control what other countries and other militaries are going to do? And why they would want to do it, I don't even understand that.
I think that terrorism is still alive today. It may not happen to that scale, but it's happening every day, everywhere around the world, not just America.
We haven't had one in 16 years, so I'm thinking we're on the right track.
That, of course, was a series of interviews that we did. Tyler Simpson, our intern here, went out and talked to some people about where they felt they were. I want to turn to Mukhtar because the thing that really struck me, particularly over the last presidential campaign, was that the current president campaigned on a ban on Muslim immigration. It's now been settled to about six countries, I guess, in terms of people coming across. The administration, of course, says it's not a Muslim ban. Well, it's a travel ban, what have you. That's being tied up in the courts. And that the whole business about terrorism being tied particularly to Islam and what we do about it seemed to come back full flush during the last campaign. How do you assess the atmosphere that we're in now as opposed to, say, a George W. Bush who went out of his way to say this is a radical group and that we welcome American Muslims? Are you there, Mukhtar? Apparently not. Okay, so I'm going to turn to so what do you make of this this atmosphere that we have at this point, coming particularly out of that campaign?
Well, I think that in that regard, President Bush did the American public a service, and that is, on the one hand, to say we've been grievously struck, and we must respond in some fashion. But at the same time, said, look, this is our Muslim Americans are our brothers and sisters, and we must not allow this act to divide them from us. And I think that was, of course, the proper way to proceed to protect civil rights and civil liberties of all Americans. And in dramatic contrast to the present president, who has, of course, pursued the opposite, saying essentially to demonize all Muslims simply because there are some Muslims who pursue violence against, in this case, against Americans, but other people as well.
How do you assess, by the way, generally sort of the war on terror? How does that compare to, say, for instance, the last sort of war we went through, which was the Cold War? I mean, obviously, there are some real distinct differences. One, obviously, you had a specific set of nation states who had particular interests that they had to protect. We're looking at sort of these stateless organizations, which don't necessarily have a particular physical asset to protect.
I think what is difficult to grasp, I think, is the multiple motivations, I think, for a lot of these groups. That on the one hand, clearly they are anti-Western, strongly anti-American, perceiving that American foreign policy has been destructive to their societies. At the same time, they are attempting to overthrow the existing governments of the nation states within which they live and work. I mean, Osama bin Laden was no friend of the Saudi regime. He was part of the millionaire class, to be sure, but he was one of those black sheep out there that was willing was essentially trying to upset, to overthrow the existing structures of Saudi Arabia. I think ISIS, the formation of ISIS, is a similar kind of development that comes out of the sectarian battles, the internal battles, in this case, certainly of Iraq, and then bleeding out into Syria. So, and this, I think that it's a much more complex picture in that respect than we were dealing with during the Cold War.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is we're looking at ISIS, and in terms of territory, they've lost something like 78% of the territory in Iraq, lost about 58% of the territory in Syria. And they, one of the things people have noted is that they have alienated other various terrorist groups. There's a suggestion that Al-Qaeda, on the other hand, is on its way back in part, and I think his son, I think in particular, Osama bin Laden's son, as people have pointed to, actually made alliances with these people and have not necessarily gone out of their way to antagonize Western powers like Europe, the United States, as, say, for instance, ISIS has done. I mean, do you think there's a shift going on there?
To be sure. I mean, because I remember several years ago we were having a conversation where ISIS was on the rise, and we correctly understood at least part of that dynamic in that ISIS was rising because there was sufficient grievance among the Sunni Arabs, particularly Sunni Iraqi Arabs, that they were being abused by the Iraqi government, which was Shia, that was not providing resources, was abusing them in various ways, and they'd rather support their own sort of a native, again, there's a sectarian opposition to that. But now ISIS, of course, has been largely, is being largely destroyed. But the grievances remain. I mean, one of the important, I think, dimensions of this that we have to keep an eye on is the rise of things like ISIS, the rise of organizations like Al-Qaeda and the like, come from major kinds of grievances within those societies, both against the United States, but against their own elite and governments within those states. And unless and until those grievances are addressed, we can expect the rise, the movement around. Once ISIS is no longer seen as an instrument for some kind of salvation, the people will gravitate to other organizations and other movements. So in this respect, at the end of this war, assuming that ISIS is indeed crushed, as it appears it will be, we should not expect that somehow that is the end of the internal dynamics and the internal conflict.
Oh, so as we look forward, in the minute we have left, what kind of movement forward do you think the United States is going to take? Or was this just going to simply simmer over a long period of time until the next guy comes along and so on? I mean, is there any end in this? As I guess the Cold War, it came to an end.
I think that at present time, the prognosis for this administration, in my view, is an unhappy one. That I don't see, I see the support for example, Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen is an indication that it's a support for the use of state violence rather than negotiated solutions to these problems.
Mm. I wonder whether or not, though, the disparities are so great and the conflict, particularly between Sunni and Shia, is so great that this thing is going to spill over for a very long time, and it's going to be everybody's problem, not just the United States. We've been talking with Michael Laughlin. He is a political science professor at Salisbury University. Also earlier, we had Mukhtar Khan. He's a professor at the University of Delaware, and also heard from some of the local folks reacting to this, the 16th anniversary this week of the attacks on 9/11. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Our human ancestors hunted and gathered, they survived and reproduced, and one day they began to ask why. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives, a journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
The town of Berlin celebrates one of country's oldest instruments, the fiddle. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. On September 22nd, music will fill the air as the 25th annual Berlin Fiddlers Convention gets underway with competitions, food, craft vendors, and beer. History of the fiddle reaches back to the earliest days of the colonists. Indeed, John Udy, a 1620 immigrant, is credited with being the first known fiddler on American soil. Early music was influenced by Irish and Scottish tunes. The South developed its own style, and as it moved westward, this democratizing instrument developed mountain and country forms of music. In our studio this morning is Nate Clendenin. He has been involved in organizing the festival, and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So let me ask you this. So let's go a little bit over the history here in terms of how fiddling and this kind of music, because obviously it also combines lots of other instruments as well, mm-hmm. but fiddle being probably the standout. Give us a sense about where the origins of this.
Well, basically, bluegrass and old-time music as we know it now descended from European settlers to the United States, as you had mentioned, and basically grew out of what came to be known as mountain music, and mountain music just being very traditional-oriented folk music from mountain folks. What ended up becoming bluegrass was basically a sped-up, almost a rock and roll almost version of it. But the way that we have it now, bluegrass has evolved into a lot of different forms, but all centered around this traditional setup of being built around a fiddle, banjo, mandolin, guitar, and bass.
What do you think makes this fiddle so special? And obviously the question, because how do you define the difference between that and, say, violin? In terms, they are obviously the same instrument, but
very true.
Done differently.
True, yes. It's an approach. It's a feel. A fiddle is no different than a violin in terms of the actual instrument. It's just how it's played. Between bluegrass and old time, those are two different disciplines of playing. I myself am not good enough at the fiddle to be able to really describe it in words. However, it's very easily heard. Old time fiddle styles are more rolling, and they just, that's the way that I think about it, at least. They just keep going. And bluegrass is more of a, more like a hard-lined, fast approach, more of a finesse approach. Another way to describe it, Cajun music is another offshoot of this as well. And if anyone's familiar with something like that, and even Celtic music, all of those four that I just mentioned, old-time, bluegrass, Cajun, and Celtic, if you can think of them, it's easy to hear where the approach is different. And it's just, it's all about technique. It's all about how the instrument is actually played.
Yeah, so I just ran across a phrase in which describing the fiddler is playing the instrument wrong. That is, that there's these differences. I mean, in terms of it, whether it's, there aren't any, for instance, chin rests, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. is a lot of double stops. Double stops, obviously, being two notes mm-hmm. Done at the mm-hmm. same time.
Yeah.
So, what is it like since you've played a bit? What is that like to play that kind of music and that kind of a genre?
Well, for me personally, once again, I'm not really a fiddler at all. I always joke when I go play gigs with my great fiddle friends is that I show up to the gig to watch them play, and I just get to stand next to them. For me, I don't know. It's just an engaging genre of music. It's an engaging. It's very accessible to a lot of people. It's born out of poor country folks in the mountains that this is how they entertain themselves. It's a very accessible, basic almost type of music, and I think that translates on a lot of levels, both for me as a performer or of bluegrass and other performers. Like it's just fun, but it translates on other levels for those who are watching it or listening to it. Like it's just really fun.
How do you say contrast it with, say, I know you play guitar. How do you contrast the two instruments? Obviously much different, but.
True. It's all kind of about the role that I can think of in the difference of that. Like a guitar in this context is a rhythm instrument. So it provides the backbone. And, the fiddle is more of the lead instrument. And once again, as I mentioned earlier, like bands are kind of built around those lead instruments. Guitar. Now you can play fiddle tunes on a guitar and all the rest of the instruments in bluegrass as well. It's just nice to bang out some chords and watch these fiddlers go. It's really fun.
So, what got you involved with, particularly with bluegrass and with this kind of genre? What appeals to you as opposed to, say, any other form of music?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, how I got into it personally, my parents are both from Virginia and are both vocalists and grew up with mountain music. So I'd always been familiar with it growing up, and we listened to it a lot. And when in my early 20s, I knew bluegrass songs and had played lots of bluegrass songs before, but I met a banjo player when I was living in Virginia myself, and he kind of showed me some of the standard songs, and we started playing bluegrass. And the more that I did it, it really came naturally to me in terms of how I approach music personally. And once again, referencing what I said earlier about how kind of basic and accessible it is, bluegrass is an old time. It's great music just to pick up and do. Once again, the chord structures aren't necessarily that complicated a lot of times. So, you know, as long as you got the rhythm together, it's really easy just to sit down and play. And it's just a great way to socialize and share things with other people. And once again, it's just accessible.
One of the things that struck me, by the way, is it and there maybe was a relationship, but it strikes me that while they are obviously different forms of music, blues that we've come to know it, that there's a reflection of that, I think, in bluegrass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a correlation. At least I feel there's a correlation across the board with folk music in general. Now, folk can be broadened to include straight up, you know, folk singer songwriter stuff, blues, bluegrass, just roots music in general. There's a lot of correlations. The chord structures, once again, are relatively basic. You can also incorporate certain licks here and there. Like, there's definitely some crossovers, but I think that really just boils down to the roots and the real folk cultural aspects of those musics that are all very similar.
And also, they seem to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that. And is that one of the things that attracts you?
Definitely. I mean, music in general is the, you know, the original form of history, basically, you know, at least telling stories and passing on certain stories to other generations. You know, a lot of the stories in bluegrass involve, you know, heartache and murder, but
the usual thing.
The subject matter, you know, is can be a little daunting at times, but yeah, you know, and once again, like, you know, like you said, just telling stories and in combination of the folk aspects of it, they're not complicated stories. They're stories that, you know, and subjects that everyone can understand.
Do you think they're stories of the people as opposed to others? I mean, do you think that it gets to that ground level of where people live?
It can. I mean, it certainly does.
I mean, I think a lot of songs that deal with, as you said, heartache or sometimes it murder, right? Right. For example, which is not the norm.
True. Luckily, most people don't know much about that. You know, and let's hope it stays that way. But, let's see. I had something formulated and I totally spaced it. Ask me the question again.
So it seems to me that bluegrass and that kind of music really is sort of at ground level. It's the mm-hmm. where people live as opposed to say other forms of music.
True. Yes. And I think it can be maybe characterized in the essence that like a lot of bluegrass band names are indicative of where these bands come from or where you grew up with, where your roots actually are. And listening to that, to those songs, you know, those are songs of those people's experience from where they're from. You know, we write songs here on the shore, I'm sure, that are, you know, our contributions, the imagery is more salt grass and water and wind, whereas maybe the imagery in the mountains would be more, you know, mountain-oriented or farming-oriented or, flooding or just stuff that is specific from where these people, where folks come from, you know, telling their story of their experience. Once again, though, like you're saying, from a ground level, from a very fundamental, basic level.
So when you were growing up, were there particular groups that you liked in bluegrass? I mean, somebody that struck you?
And well, I had an epiphany recently that I really enjoy female songwriters and performers. And I mean, I enjoy all sorts, but I've always like there's some great folks out there. And it occurred to me that I was raised on Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton, and not that that was something that I didn't realize, but maybe it's something that has translated into, how I approach music today, or what I really like about a lot of music today.
Mm-hmm. Anything in particular that you liked about them, or you...
Well, they're just
it's so more good. Soulful, or
it's maybe it's just aesthetic, maybe it's just how it all sounds, or something. And basically, well, a little more along the lines of that, Emmylou and Dolly were I think the first bluegrass performers, and they don't do bluegrass all the time either.
Right.
I should note that. But that started formulating my aesthetic in this. And then through that, I later have discovered Tony Rice. And Tony, I just think, is somebody who I base a lot of my approach to the guitar on. I'll never be able to pick like him. And bluegrass is such a large family, you know, even at the top levels of the business, people just, and this ties into the community aspect of it I mentioned earlier, like people just play together. And, you know, all you need to do is get into one person and then see who those people played with. And then you're just keeps expanding into, I mean, just an endless amount of great music.
Yeah, oftentimes, by the way, and in some of the music that I've seen here, even on the shore, is that various groups that they will interchange, that you'll see one group of people and then one person will disappear, somebody else will show up, mm-hmm. or maybe somebody will come in and play with them. It seems almost as if there's a certain sort of free form, I guess, in some ways about the music.
Well, there's a lot of traditional songs. There's a very large songbook of material that basically everybody knows. Which is definitely not the case in rock and roll or jazz. Well, maybe a bit in jazz, because there certainly are standards in jazz. But in rock and roll and other forms of music, you don't have this. I mean, everyone has a certain amount of songs that people have been playing for 100 years, and that's awesome. That lends itself to a lot of just random creativity. I played shows this weekend with one person I had never even met before, let alone played with. And, you know, and it was just, we had a lot of common stuff, and it was, you know, all we had to do was count it off and say what key it was in, and we were off.
A lot of improvisation, I guess.
Yes, definitely.
Which I guess is what which makes it, I think, in some ways similar, not exactly, but similar to like jazz. Jazz, which is, there's a lot of improvisation. Mm-hmm. And I've seen where, yeah, okay, so you write, for instance, if you have the fiddler, and he comes on, does his thing. It may not be exactly the same thing the next time he plays, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of room for creativity. And in a lot of these fiddle tunes, meaning instrumental songs with certain melodies and rhythmic qualities, there's a lot of room to expand on them. And it's, once again, it's not... Bluegrass is certainly more of a finesse approach, per se, to, say, old time. But either way, both of the genres, or subgenres, there's a lot of room just to expand, just to try something new, and it can be very, very, very fun.
So you have, amongst other things, I've talked a little bit about some of the folks who are showing up, the Eastman String Band, mm-hmm. and this thing that's called Altgrass Sound. What is Altgrass?
You know.
Can you tell me exactly what sounds?
I wish we had Tim
here
to really tell you that. I think it's just that they play some stuff that's a little bit outside the box.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, there are some bands that you'll hear, or that anyone can hear, that's they'll play straight traditional music. You know, all the material they're playing is very old. And in bluegrass, there's in old time, there's a certain respect and focus on tradition. Now, once again, some bands focus solely on that tradition, which is awesome. Some bands take that, like Tony Rice, when the New Grass Revival, when those folks came, extremely progressive, and the way that things have evolved 30, 40 years later, they're maybe not as progressive. I mean, they're certainly not as progressive now in terms of throwing new things in as they were then. But with the alt grass, that's just the way they describe their brand of what they do. I mean, they do plenty of traditional stuff, but they do other covers as well, and just other stuff, and incorporate some newer things into it.
And also, you highlighted the Last Minutemen. Who are they? They're apparently from Delmarva. And what kind are they? More traditional?
It'll be interesting to see what they do in their set. They assembled last year for the competition, and it's a handful of guys from around here that play a lot together. Mickey Justice, he's been a part of several of the winning bands over the years under my tenure at the festival. I'm trying to think who else was in that group.
So we got Wes, Bart, Mickey, Basement, and Larry Lynch.
Yeah. Wes and Mickey are two great bluegrass pickers. Wes lives down on the Eastern Shore of Virginia. Mickey lives locally here. They came together and played, and I believe last year was their first time together as this specific group. However, once again, bluegrass is a very wide open, family oriented thing. These guys have all been playing together for years, that's what they ended up playing as last year, and they won. So,
By the way, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the country grass. I've seen them a number of times, even in some open mic venues. They'll stop by and play, and so on and so forth. Tell me a little bit about them. They seem more traditional,
definitely. And they do some outside the box stuff too, some more country oriented stuff. I believe it was 1980 when Bill Vollmer, who's plays mandolin around here. They got that band started. They've just been around for a while. I mean, they're kind of the Eastern Shore, as far as I know, the Eastern Shore's original bluegrass group. And they do all sorts of stuff in and around Berlin. And they've been for years have been hosting the Sunday Jam, which happens kind of as like to cap off the festivities of the Fiddler's Convention. And that's always fun. There's tons of people involved with that. And it's a great, great, great way to spend a Sunday afternoon.
And by the way, you mentioned that you have a new championship, a flat picking championship.
Yes, the Maryland State Guitar Maryland State Flat Picking Guitar Championship.
Right.
Yeah. Basically, with a bluegrass guitar state championship. There's an event out in Western Maryland that had hosted the state championship for fiddle, banjo and mandolin, I believe, and they weren't doing the guitar part, and I called them, and after a lot of phone calls, we were able to assert that we were going to do the guitar championship this year, which is very exciting. I don't know, I can't wait. It's a great way for this event. This marks the 25th anniversary of the Berlin Fiddler's Convention, and so this has been going a while. And it'll be nice to start this part of the tradition as well with the championship.
Now, obviously, you play the guitar. What do you think is the hardest thing about, say, flat picking?
It's the technique. And it's funny, it's called a flat pick for a reason, because it's so thick that it doesn't bend.
Doesn't bend, yeah.
And when I first started playing with a flat pick myself, was right at the start of when I started learning true bluegrass, and it was really complicated. However, now I play my electric guitars with a flat pick, and I think just the technique of it. Bluegrass is a very physical way to play music. I mean, it's very fast, it's very clean, you know, like it's it can be very challenging as basic as the songs are set up. It can be very, very challenging to play. My biggest challenge is just staying in shape. I mean, seriously, my elbow is sore from these gigs this past weekend, just from the amount of work we're doing out there.
So what is it, do you think, that I mean, this, as you say, this festival hasn't gone on about 25 years. Mm-hmm. It seems to get a big draw. It seems mm-hmm. to be a lot of people. Are we looking at people when they come there? Are they coming from other parts of the region or the country, or is this a predominantly local audience? What, how do you read that?
Honestly, people come from all over the region. Some folks have come from farther away than others, but I mean, it's an annual thing. And once again, the testament of bluegrass and old time in general is like, it's once again, it's very accessible and it's naturally just kind of fun to watch. But there are tons of people that make their yearly pilgrimage down to the shore at this time because you're able to come to this event. And Berlin hosts plenty of super fun events. This one is the only one of its kind and has been going the longest. And it's just always encouraging to see people of all ages really enjoying themselves, you know. And I mean, and it's very family friendly, extremely family friendly. There's always, you know, children dancing in front of the stage and behind them is their grandparents. And it's just, it's people of all walks of life and all ages. It's just appeals. Bluegrass is very wide open thing and appeals to a lot of people.
And this obviously is a big event for, say, Berlin, but I assume that these are, you have these kinds of conventions and festivals around the country.
Mm-hmm. Then, all over the place.
Yeah.
In fact, when I the first Fiddler's Convention I ever went to was the Galax Fiddler's Convention in Galax, Virginia, which happens the first full week in August every year. And this year, I did not go this year, sadly. I think it was the 82nd or 3rd, something in the 80s. And it's the oldest running and largest Fiddler's Convention in the country. And there are tons all over this region. You know, Virginia, Gettysburg has a big bluegrass event. We're happy. Ours is definitely a lot smaller scale than some of the other ones. Galax, for instance, goes for an entire week. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of competitors. And ours is, you know, obviously considerably more compact than that, but it's nice to be a part of a much larger national tradition. You know, this is, you know, bluegrass and old time music is very much a part of the national fabric on a lot of levels. And, you know, it's nice to be a part of that, and that we can have a little bit of that here on the shore.
So somebody suggested that bluegrass tends to be sort of a niche kind of music. There, for instance, there will be radio stations that will put it on, mm-hmm. and then if they take it off, they hear that the fans seem to be very passionate about it. I mean, is there a limiting quality, do you think, to the music? What do you think? I mean,
possibly.
I mean, I guess that's true. In one way or another.
You know, but if you don't like twang, you know, if you don't like fiddles, you know, then you're probably not going to like bluegrass. Yeah, it is definitely something that does have a niche in general, but once again, it's bluegrass has never really been pop music, you know. So, you know, there's been certainly people, Alison Krauss, I think, is the best example, and Dolly Parton can, you know, have crossed over back and forth between pop music and bluegrass, but I just think that it just hasn't been tainted by pop in the essence that, like, it's still kind of a pure form. Even the folks that are playing really outside the box stuff, you know, very non-traditional bluegrass, it's still more traditional than, you know, country music or whatever. So, I mean, people inevitably will formulate some passions for it because it's, I mean, it changes, but you know, real bluegrass is a certain thing. you know, real country music can be a million things. Like, real bluegrass is definitely a certain thing.
You know, people, do you think that explains some of the passion that that people have? I mean,
sure.
You really get a pushback if it disappears, kind of thing.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, it's very personal to people, you know, and I mean, that could be for any number of reasons, but you know, I just, there's just a lot more involved with bluegrass and old time, you know, than top 40 country music, you know, songs about trucks and whatever, which is fine. Don't get me wrong. You know, that's totally
trucks
cool.
Are okay.
Trucks are fine. But, you know, I think freight trains carry a whole lot more emotion with them than the, you know, than a truck does.
I hope you don't lose any audience for that.
And just to clarify, in bluegrass, there are a lot of songs about freight trains. That was my reference there.
That's true. Well, we were speaking with Nate Clendenin. He has been organizing the festival, which is the 25th annual Berlin Fiddlers Convention, which gets underway on September 22nd, runs the entire weekend, mm-hmm. and we'll probably see a lot of folks out there. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
And I will say, this is a large team effort. So, I mean, yes, I've definitely had a lot to do with the planning sides, but there's a lot of great folks with Berlin Chamber of Commerce who puts on this event, and then a great team of folks in Berlin that are all working on this. I'm just the guy that came in to talk about it.
Well, we appreciate you.
They send me here to talk.
Well, we've been talking again with Nate Clendenin, one of the organizers of the festival. I appreciate you stopping by. This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Del Marva Today, a production of Del Marva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Del Marva Today podcast in iTunes. Del Marva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.